And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. It's coming up on 6 o'clock, March 19th, 1998. Time for Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. That's Civil Rights for the Poor here in Santa Cruz. I have a lot of stuff tonight about areas not in Santa Cruz. Watsonville, Salinas, surrounding areas you don't usually hear about on this show from 6 to 8. And we're also going to have some interviews with folks around the neighborhood of the Brian Andrus shooting. That's over on Button Street on Sunday. Some interesting and thought-provoking comments from some of the neighbors and some real eyewitnesses, not just the kind you read that are hepped up in the Santa Cruz County Sentinel, chosen by the police department and trumpeted by writer Karen Clark. Stay with us. Peter, Paul, and Mary from a real old album of theirs, A Song Will Rise, When the Ship Comes In, sung by Bob Dylan. That's, boy, I was almost a boy when that one came out. Still good, and for those of you who have $30, all the rich kids in the audience, make your way to the Civic Auditorium tonight. Apparently, Peter, Paul, and Mary are doing a benefit for the United Farm Workers. In fact, interesting article on that in today's San Francisco Examiner, which, by the way, is the cheapest paper in town. If you pay a quarter, you get lots of interesting stuff, although it's usually a day old. You get the national edition down here, not the daily edition on the same day. But you can pick it up at the 7-Elevens and the convenience stores, and it really is probably the best bet for a quarter around. I recommend it of any daily paper in the area. I mean, they're all pretty bad, and the Examiner is really no exception, but they cover homeless matters in San Francisco better. They cover matters of police misconduct better. They're kind of I don't want to call them the alternative newspaper because they're not really an alternative, but they're worth having a look at, particularly for a quarter. Peter, Paul, and Mary. We're going to be following some with some more songs of theirs tonight because I like them, and also because they're going to be playing tonight in a good cause to unionize the strawberry workers, and that's an important thing. As I said, I'll try to read you a little bit about that later. Right now, let me give you a brief overview of today's edition of Bathrob Spears Broadsides, 6 to 8. For those who are new to the show, I call myself Bathrob Spear because when I'm out there with homeless people and we're peacefully protesting the laws that make it illegal for homeless people to be in public places, I often wear a bathrobe in order to give a little kind of theatrical flair to things, provide a hook for a media look at what goes on, give the issue some publicity. So, for instance, in our own city here in Santa Cruz, we have a law called the sleeping ban, which makes it illegal for homeless to be sleeping anywhere after 11 o'clock at night or covering up with blankets even if they're not asleep. That sounds pretty amazing in this day and age, but it's true. If you cover up with a blanket or if you fall asleep in a vehicle or on public property anywhere, with the exception of, well, actually there are no exceptions on public property, period. But on private property, it's also forbidden unless you're in a fenced-in side yard or backyard, unless you are on church property in a vehicle with the permission of the church, and only one of three vehicles are allowed, and that's only two or three churches that actually do that here in Santa Cruz. You can be given a $162 ticket on the first offense and, theoretically, given a sentence of up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine for the second offense within 48 hours of, I remind you, sleeping or covering up with blankets. So that's one of our problems here in Santa Cruz, medieval laws, and it's kind of compounded by the fact that we have a city council that likes to present itself as a bunch of liberals or progressives or enlightened individuals. And how enlightened individuals could have such a law in their books, of course, is really a serious question for anyone who hears about the law. And we, of course, have been circulating a petition, those of us concerned, the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Ban, we call ourselves, to end that law, to make it much more fair situation whereby you still won't be able to camp, won't be able to set up a tent, you won't be able to start cooking weenies in the downtown area over an open fire, but you will be able to sleep if you have no legal place to go. There will be areas of the city, such as industrial areas, where you can go sleep without being ticketed or harassed by the police unless you're engaging in other kinds of illegal behavior. And if you're interested in helping this campaign to end the sleeping ban here, we're going to be doing a big push, as we call it, a big push on Saturday. That's in 2 days, Saturday, March 21st, and it'll be starting at 11:30 in the morning at Loudoun Nelson Center. Everybody who's listening to this is invited to come help us go door to door with petitions and get people signed up for this initiative. We need probably about 6,500 signatures on the ballots to do this because, as you may know, those of you who have been following this kind of thing, even though the Pelton Garden Project, which Pelton Street property, attempt to keep that property for the Homeless Garden Project and community gardens and stop the city council from disposing of it to the big developers and the rich million-dollar houses, even though there were, 5,500 signatures turned in and only 3,800 required, the city clerk threw out half of them, so that measure did not qualify for the ballot, so we are going to need, similarly, lots of extra signatures. And so come on down to the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Ban's big push on Saturday at 11:30 at Loudoun Nelson Center. Loudoun Nelson Center is down on Laurel and Center Streets. It's the large community center building. Come on in. You're going to be welcome. I may even greet you with a bathrobe. Who knows? I promise I'm harmless. If you're interested in finding out what's going on, you want more information, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. HUFF is an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, name of a civil rights group that I've been working with, writing for, and talking about for the last decade. 423 Huff, if you want more information, come down for the big push for the sleeping ban repeal, 11:30 on Saturday morning. Now, you may remember, I'm sure you remember it if you've been reading the papers, the second serious police shooting in 4 months happened on Sunday afternoon, evening, around 6:30, actually probably a little bit before that, on Button Street, which is a street right near in the Emmeline area, near the freeway, or out kind of out near the Denny's Ocean Street area. And I got a tip from Skidmark Bob Duran, a free radio broadcaster, who called me up and said the police have shot someone again. As you may remember, back in November, they shot dead Happy John Dine downtown. Well, this time, the man that was shot, like 8 to 10 bullets were fired. I think 3 or 4 are lodged in the man. It's not clear, even now from news reports, exactly how many times he was shot. He was a resident, not a poor man, somewhat higher bracket, not that much higher, but he at least had a place to live. And we went to the scene, we talked to numerous people, and those of you who've been listening to free radio probably heard loop tapes of some of the interviews that we had with the folks who were on the scene. Well, we're trying to put together a series of longer interviews with neighbors, some of whom wished to remain anonymous, others of whom were willing to say who they were, telling what they saw. And what I'm going to play for you now actually is kind of to set the scene. It's a rough tape of what we recorded when we got on the scene. And to those who are listening, including the neighbors who we've let know by phone that this broadcast is happening, this is an unedited tape that actually comes simply off the street. So if you hear something that you don't like on it, it's not because we have betrayed you in any way. It's because this actually was what was said in a public place, for when everyone was watching. And so we haven't edited this. It's simply the initial reactions of the community to what happened that evening on Button Street. And we had hoped to be able to have a phone line set up by today here in the studio, because as you may remember, all you old-timers who are Free Radio Santa Cruz listeners, we have in the past had a phone line into the studio that you can call, and we can engage in the really important part of the show, which is the dialogue with the community and on what's going on. Plus, of course, we can follow breaking news, we can get opposing voices, and so forth. Now, unfortunately, there are problems on the phone line, so we haven't been able to do that, but we actually are on the edge of that, because the phone man was here today. I saw him. I mean, I walked past him as I walked into the studio. He was trying to set up a line. He was saying that there was some problem on the line. He was going to take him a little longer, and so it couldn't be done today. But don't despair. This is coming soon. We're going to have a call-in number. Until then, Free Radio's voicemail number, if you want to reach Free Radio, is 427-4523. So all you folks listening out there, please call us and give us your thoughts. If you have anything you want broadcast on the air, we are happy to broadcast public service announcements. Again, the phone number is 427-4523. And the email address for all you computer folks is FRSC, for Free Radio Santa Cruz, at Cruzio, C-R-U-Z-I-O, .com. C-O-M-M. Is that right? I thought it would be 1M. Well, try both. See what happens. Post Office Box 7507 Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And again, the phone number 427-4523. If you want to get a live voice and you want me returning your call because you're referring to subjects on my show, my phone number is 423-HUFF, 423-4833. So we're going to proceed directly to the second part of a tape of people on the scene on Button Street Sunday evening. A man was shot in front of an apartment by 3 police officers. Actually, 4 drew their guns, but the fourth didn't shoot. After the man's door was forced by Officer Garazio, or Boots Garazio as we call him, for his tendency, predilection for waking up homeless people by kicking them at the City Hall sleepers protest in 1996. We're going to talk more about Garazio as we proceed.
Good morning, Cruz.
In fact, we have a guest entering the studio even as we speak. It doesn't look like Officer Garazio, though. Instead, I'm afraid it's his nemesis. it's dead-on Dave Silva, who's involved in all kinds of projects, ranging from defending the rights of folks at Pelton Street, who want to secure that community property for the community and not for rich developers, to
stopping the super freeway, Highway 117 interchange.
This man, you can't shut him up, and you can't talk over him. He's a real liability. But David, before we get into you, we promised our audience we're going to give them a little bit of this tape about the again conversations from Button Street when the shooting occurred, and
my neighborhood.
That's right. That is your neighborhood, isn't it?
Yeah, it was quite a fireworks show.
Well. We're gonna want your input into this, and of course we're gonna have input from a couple of other folks here, guests in the studio, talking about what happened on Button Street and kind of trying to compare the different news accounts from the Sentinel and Mercury News. Today there was a report in the Good Times. Let's hear some of the original voices from that situation.
I was told that a neighbor was in the house and saw the person who was going after them from in the house, who called 911 himself and thought the person was gone, and then opened the door to see if they were gone, and then the person was shot by someone who came to their house.
No,
that's why I came over here, because you hear
said that. He was taking a shower, but he came out from the bathroom, and then he went out to the window because somebody knocked on his door, and then he ran away. So
inside the house, or
no? Yeah, inside of the house, something like that. And then when he opened the door, there was nobody in there, and then he looked at the window, and
Where'd you get this from?
I don't know. There was just like persons talking.
Yeah, about talking. Right. And that's why I wanted to hear for myself, you know, is this really what happened? But I would like to make a point. And if you look behind you, you see that boat that's covered with the blue tarp and this trailer. Just, 2 weeks ago, this house was on the news for quite a few nights in a row, that there was a man that was in this house who was involved with child pornography on the internet. And now, right across the street, now we have a shooting. And for this complex, we have 144 children that live in our complex, plus all, I don't know how many adults, but there's quite a few apartments. So, we want to feel like we live in a safe neighborhood in Santa Cruz, and we want peace in our lives. And yet right here, 2 weeks ago, this house was on the news like the past three or four nights in a row, plus the man who was convicted of a felony, child abuse, and now directly across the street, here's another home, with some kind of a problem, and there was a shooting. So maybe that's why they reacted so fast, because there was a felony, involved right here, which is right across the street. And since this is right here, and we live right there, you can't really separate that from the neighborhood. You know, it's like, oh gosh, the neighborhood's changing. You know, I thought I was living in a peaceful environment in a nice place in Santa Cruz, and now look what's happening. This was, 2 weeks ago, and now this.
If they had a problem with that man, they're not going to resolve nothing by shooting people or killing people. They just can, resolve things by talking and not yelling, shooting people, fighting with people. They just can, resolve them by themselves, because if they shoot somebody or get in a fight, then everybody's going to be scared, and then they're going to think that it's going to happen to them.
And then, you walk through the neighborhood and you want to be friendly with your neighbors, but then on the other hand, if all of this is happening, you kind of withdraw within to yourself, like they do in big cities where people don't talk to each other, and that's really not the way it should be.
People get together after, when these incidents happen, is when people start talking. It's kind of ironic. Well, thanks again. Your name is?
Okay, I'm Faith.
You're Faith, and you're?
Adriana.
Adriana?
Yeah.
And, of course, Laura. And thank you both, or all three of you.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
All right. It's ridiculous to have CPS involved?
It's ridiculous to have CPS involved because, first of all, we have rights as citizens to be safe within our homes. And if this woman was indeed having an argument with her husband and called her neighbor over here for help and was explaining a situation to her neighbor, even the neighbor could have taken care of the child, whom the child knows and is comfortable with, or maybe a next-door neighbor.
Okay.
But for the police to step into an argument and have CPS immediately involved is...
And actually, this part of the tape you're listening to, transcript of, an account of folks' reactions at the Button Street right after the shooting. There was initial concern that the child of the woman in the house whose husband was shot was taken by CPS, and this neighbor was very concerned because apparently she's had bad experience with CPS, and actually on our show we've had some discussion of the difficulties folks, particularly homeless folks, get into with CPS. But in this particular case, as far as I know, it turned out that the concern that CPS had taken the child, I think, was not accurate, because I came by the next day and I saw the mother and the child there, and so that was not in fact a real concern. It was a real concern, but it was one that turned out to be an unjustified fear. You're going to get some of that as you listen to this tape, some folks who, you know, expressing immediate concerns and fears, and that's a natural thing that happens after this kind of a shooting or this kind of a situation, and I think it's part of the whole picture that we're getting here, and we're going to correct some of the misimpressions that are given in terms of the facts as we learn them.
Actually, I heard on the news
to open
that
the door,
night that the mother and child were taken to a safe house.
Right. Yeah. Now that they were, the point we noticed was that they were taken against their will. They didn't want to leave, and they were forced to leave. That was the point. And we were told they were taken to the police station, and that they were denied access to an attorney. A neighbor came up and wanted to give them access to an attorney, and the police drove him away. I should say, told him to leave. Didn't drive him anywhere, but insisted he walk off. Let's hear a little more of this tape.
All right.
The man came out with a bottle in his hand and a baseball bat. Again, this is the patched-up story, which I'm not sure if it's actually accurate or not. And then the man, according to what we later heard from an interview that the woman in this house had with the woman in the house, the woman was being harassed by a police officer. The man became angry. He threw a bottle at the police officer, and they shot him. That is the claim that's made. Now, whether it's actually accurate, I'm not sure.
Well,
if it's true, of course, it doesn't sound good for the police. Right? But, you know, maybe there are more factors involved.
It makes me feel even more afraid of police and just, you know, where are my rights? You know, if I want to be safe within my house and if I want to have my child, if a police comes to my door and says, we're going to take your child away from you, you know,
and then they call
CPS, then it takes years through the courts to try to get your child back.
That's right.
This is a really difficult, this can be a really out-of-hand situation.
Maybe I should get your number and contact you later. Is that possible?
The result of CPS taking the child will be, first of all, an open case. Okay, the child is in custody of CPS right now, and
of course, as we learned, the child is not in custody of CPS, but this gives you some idea of what would result did that happen, and of course, this does happen in other cases.
The police are involved, and CPS is involved, and so this is an open case, and that gives them, CPS, an open door into this woman and this man's life. And so this will give them the ability to interfere with this family now for like the next 3 years probably.
Yeah.
And that's the point that I was making about CPS.
And an important point.
Is it?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And that's what's really sad about life today is because, you know, when the police get involved, there's so much paperwork. I mean, you're talking about court dates and paperwork and you know, just we're talking from one moment of panic
from this man, you know, who was afraid,
right.
who came out of his house, you know, who had no weapon, obviously.
There's only that in a bottle.
At a moment of fear, okay,
right.
he probably picked up the first thing, you know, that he had, which was a bottle and a baseball bat.
Right.
And who knows why he was afraid. But in some kind of self-defense, you know, in his home, if that's all that he had to defend himself with, you know, now we're talking about an open case with a child that is, you know, displaced from his family, displaced from the mother. The mother's going to go through trauma from a difficult life, and, you know, this is going to be an open case now for a while. And that's why I'm saying that things can get really out of hand.
Again, our information is tentative. It could be that the child was taken in some more temporary way. Do we know, Becky, if it was CPS that took the child? Or?
I have some video of the woman. Perhaps if we showed it to the Petersons, they could identify whether it was the mother or a CPS worker.
Right, so who knows? I mean, it certainly, we hope it's not CPS because of the problems that would develop if, in fact, it was. And our concern was that it was CPS. Yeah, we're not sure. And the monoxide poisoning here.
Yeah, well, that's
and as it turned out, it was not CPS.
The man came home in the white car. He drove up over the curb and down the embankment some point. And stopped the car, and got out of the car. He was yelling, and he went in the house. And shortly thereafter, the woman came out. His wife came up, got in the car, and drove it,
right.
parked it correctly. Mm-hmm. She returned to the house, and then about 5 minutes later, the police arrived. And I'm not sure how they got into the house, but when they were in the house, they were confronting the woman, and they had her hands up in the air,
mm-hmm.
and. At that point, her husband, who was obviously intoxicated, became upset and picked up the bottles and the baseball bat, and apparently he threw one of the bottles at the police.
Where'd you get this from?
Piecing it together from all the stories I heard.
The kid eyewitness said it happened in front of the house. Remember that? R.J.
Yeah.
Peterson.
And the bat is right out in front there, too, on
let's
the
go,
grass.
Let's go take a look here.
Too.
We're looking at the front of the house and...
Right, and so the bat is there right on the edge of the sidewalk and the grass, and it's probably, oh God, what is that, 12 feet from the edge of the fence near the front door.
So the bat is outside, which would seem to contradict the story you heard about it happening inside.
No, I didn't hear that he'd been shot inside. In fact, I had heard he'd been shot outside, out of doors, and that there were a number of children on the sidewalk that witnessed the shooting.
His office was here. We have Lieutenant Haley, Sergeant Seeley, Sergeant... two more I don't recognize, but any of the names of. Looks like at least 10, 15 police officers now kind of in and about us. It's growing dark, stars right overhead. And you also have two or three.
Police Chief Belcher has come.
Right. Police Chief is here as well as numerous sergeants and a lieutenant. Is there anything more we want to do here back here, or should we just hit the road? What do you think?
There's supposed to be some sort of press conference. That probably might
How you
be
doing?
Place at the station.
Good. What was that?
Encountered any hostility? Well, little hostility, but no.
Told me to move.
No lack of cooperation, at least. No cooperation, but no direct obstruction from the police.
One police officer did ask. He says, "Excuse me, could you move over there?" And I said, "What?"
Right.
I'm trying to have a conversation here. And so,
mm-hmm.
Well, I don't want you to overhear it. You know. Oh. That was about the closest thing. I wouldn't.
Did you move?
It. No.
Right.
They had to move the conversation away from me,
now,
as it should be.
Yeah, of course. Now, he's a suspicious-looking individual with some kind of object on his shoulder.
Yeah, walking composite sketch, that's me.
Where's your baseball bat? That's what I want to know.
I'm I'm not into sports.
I was afraid about this guy in number 71 when he came up to the door and he asked Lieutenant Havey if he could go into his house.
Mm-hmm.
And Havey gave him permission to walk on the sidewalk up to the door. And then I thought he was going to get shot by these other cops. They started screaming, "Hey, you, get out of there!" And I'm like, oh, God.
Broad lights so folks, so they can photograph the crime scene where the police shot down a man with a beer bottle and a baseball bat, so the story goes. Myself, television videographer Chip, and Becky Johnson, the lonely civilian contingent remaining here. The rest of it looking like police officials. It's about 10 to 8 my time, which is probably about 15 to 8 everybody else's time. There's blood on the sidewalk. You know,
right directly near the front door.
And the baseball bat is on the grass, about 15 feet from the door. Other items strewn around. Do you see what those items are, Becky?
It looks like paper or articles of clothing. Also, there are some further over there, some little marks in the grass. We thought those might be shell casings. That's where the blood is, right there at the corner. Probably, I'd say about 7 or 8 feet from the front door. Out on the sidewalk directly.
Right, it's actually kind of, it extends over about half the sidewalk, blocks about half the sidewalk area. A little sidewalk down there in front of the apartment or condo. And of course, front.
Okay, that's a sheriff that's looking at it now. And as is usual in officer-involved shootings, of which Santa Cruz Police Department is getting to be routine, they call in the Sheriff's Department to do an investigation. Supposedly they have some, that they're more objective is the theory behind that.
I don't know, the guy over there, the fellow in green, it says Sheriff on his back. Is that
right? Looking for bullets?
I guess, I'm not sure what they're looking, could be they're looking for bullets. You can see there, of course, the blood on the sidewalk.
Yep.
And we're talking again with Jeff Peterson?
Rick
Peterson, sorry. By the way, we're the people who sent the journalist to your door. My apologies if he caused trouble.
That's good.
That's good. I thought it'd be useful for them to get at least some facts on the issue.
Those bullet holes in the fence?
It could be. Could be their bullet holes in the fence. I can't tell. I'm kind of nearsighted.
Anywhere else?
Did this stand?
Yeah.
He's still alive then?
Apparently. Yeah.
And you say is his wife we're talking about? What's the name of the woman who was indoors? Her first name?
Oh, what's her first name? Lori.
Was Lori... Lori is still being held by police?
Yeah.
And how do we know that?
Because she would probably come to our house when she gets home.
That's it. Because you guys are pretty close friends?
Yeah, and they took Lori and the baby away, and they failed to put the baby in a car seat, in a baby seat.
And do we know if this was a CPS or?
No. It was a squad car with no child seat.
I think they need a ticket for that one. How long have you known him?
Well, a year.
And was he employed or?
No, he was unemployed. His wife works full time in Scotts Valley. At the vitamin company in Scotts Valley.
And you say this guy played with your kids?
Yeah.
So you trusted him?
He skateboarded with the kids a lot, yeah.
So you know him?
Yeah.
Can I talk to you?
Not really, no.
Okay, can you tell me his name?
Brian.
And his last name is Vaughn?
I'll tell you what. How about if I don't show your face?
Yeah.
I just shoot you right from the back? And you can talk. I just want to get it on tape because I'm not a reporter.
I'd rather wait and just find out exactly why he got shot.
Okay, in that case, I'll point it over here. I just want to get the sound so my reporter can write the story.
Okay.
Great. How about if I just shoot your feet? Is that okay?
I don't like those shoes.
No, no.
Okay,
no.
Go ahead and tell me, oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, it's okay. Okay, go ahead and tell me his name and what he's like.
What he's like?
Yeah. What's his name, first of all?
Brian.
What's his last name, do you know?
I don't know what his last name is.
Starts with a V.
Brian Vaughn, I believe. I'm not quite sure. I think it's Brian Vaughn. I know his wife actually more than I know him. So.
Okay, so...
But they have a really, really nice little daughter who we adore a lot. And the man, Brian, liked to... He skateboarded with all the kids around here. And it's really unfortunate that my son borrows his skateboard all the time and, you know, and to have... To have my son see him get shot down right in front of his face is pretty devastating for most of the kids around here because he was an avid surfer and skateboarder. So,
sure, I can't get that on camera.
No, not yet, not yet.
Okay.
But I tell you what, I live in that blue house. And
okay.
As soon as I find out more detail.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks a lot. So,
then was Brian a violent man as far as you know?
Well, he. The only violence I know in his past is that he has had an altercation with a policeman before.
What sort of altercation?
I don't know. I don't know the details about it.
Right.
But I suppose he's like you and I. He was real leery about the police force, and he was a big guy, and he was big and tall and in good shape.
Did he ever threaten you?
No. He's real gentle with us.
Is he abusive with your kids in any way?
No, not at all.
Did he have an alcohol problem as far as you could see?
Never seen him drunk in my... That's why they say he came home drunk tonight. In fact, I was just talking to my wife about it. In 1 year, I've never seen him intoxicated once.
He's a white Caucasian.
Yes.
And his first name's Brian.
Brian, yeah.
Do you know about how old he is?
Oh, yeah, same age I am. Mid-30s, maybe.
Right.
But I've never seen him intoxicated once. Never once.
And how much
time... I know his wife didn't drink, so I don't know if... I doubt very seriously that he did. He was just, you know... He's sober more. I've never seen him intoxicated.
Did he have a bad temper?
I never seen it.
Do you have mental problems? I'm looking for all the things that are going to appear in the paper tomorrow morning.
Right. Well, I don't know. I don't know. That's hard to say. He was just quiet, but he played with all the kids. He skateboarded with all the kids. Not any mental disabilities that I know of.
So he was a sociable fellow, good with children?
Not highly sociable, no. Not highly sociable. Quiet, actually.
Now, you say that your wife heard from Lori, his wife, that the incident really acquired immediacy and a problem because... She felt she was being bothered by the police, or
yes, that's what she claimed. Yes.
And do we know exactly what happened?
Police had her. No, not really. But I will know, and you're more welcome to call me. We'll get to the bottom of it.
Okay.
But apparently, police had her arms up in the air, and he came in, and he sort of didn't like the police anyway, and he saw that how they were treating her, and I guess he just went off.
So he was in the shower or something?
I don't know. Yeah. I really don't know.
Yeah, we'll be catching different
stuff. Yeah.
So maybe we'll catch more of it from you.
We'll get to the bottom of it.
Going to be up late tonight?
Yeah, I'm curious to see what the news say, but, you know, I'm curious to get the police's side of it, too. So.
Sure. Are you working yourself? Or?
Yeah, working a lot.
And that was Rick Peterson, one of the neighbors of Brian Andrus on Button Street. Brian was the man shot by police, and I think he's still in either serious or fair condition over in San Jose and under arrest. And hopefully we're going to have a discussion about that here in the studio if our other guests show up with their written material on that. But at the moment, we do have another man who showed up on the scene very soon after it happened, a man who lives nearby, a man you heard from earlier, David Silva. Hi, David.
Hi, Robert. I didn't see anything before it happened, but I was in my home when I heard the shots. I heard first one shot and then a slew of shots that sound so much like you know, like 24 shots, like a firecracker pack, that I just dismissed the first one. So I just assumed that they were firecracker shots. And then I got a call that, you know, there was a shooting on Button Street, and that's behind, you know, my backyard twice over is Button Street. So with my roommate's insistence, we strolled down there. I didn't really want to get involved in another police shooting in any way, but I strolled down there, and I just was observant. I noticed Officer Kruger right away. We said hello. I saw clusters of neighbors in different places. So I went with my tape recorder and went from cluster to cluster, and I also left fairly early too. But I did notice a sort of a pattern of the story as it was developing. You go to one cluster of people, and they were talking about how unnecessary the police shooting was. That it was just, you know, whether he had a baseball bat or whether he was just throwing glass, how unnecessary it was. And then I go to you know, back to the cluster of sort of more the children. There were a lot of children being interviewed. They were like from 12, 14 years old. And I noticed that the children would be telling the story in one version, and they'd say they'd seen the baseball bat. And then as they were pressed, it was actually that the landlord had told them about a baseball bat earlier. So they had just sort of added that onto the story. And then the throwing of the glass that they reported came to find out actually that was something that they had heard from a police officer. One police officer was getting the story, I guess, from the fellow Josh, and while he was getting the story, I noticed at the beginning of his story, he said that he didn't see any baseball bat, but then as he was embellished and told the story of the police officer, he mentioned that he saw the baseball bat. So I corrected him. I said, well, I thought you just said you didn't see that, and the officer stopped me for interrupting. I didn't mean to be interrupting the interview, but he wasn't writing down the earlier parts. He was writing down the embellished parts, and I thought it was, you know, a little bit of a responsibility of another adult to point that out. But I backed off, and I just noticed by the time that they got to the press, what they had heard from the police officers and what they'd heard, you know, in the various interviews, and what they'd heard from the landlord and what they heard from other adults is really what they were reporting as having seen. And I thought that was kind of interesting. You have to be very, very careful when you're doing these investigations. Certainly, whatever happened, the number of shots, you know, I heard, it was just incredible, the number of shots. It just, I can't imagine somebody being shot for throwing a glass or just wielding a bat. With that many officers involved, it's just beyond belief. And one of the things I noticed in talking in some of the other clusters is that the parents, especially across the street from the project, were very, very upset because their children play in those yards too, and they were all very, very concerned that this police shooting was not the actual shooting of guns was not necessary at all. There was no attempt to clear away the children. I guess there were children in the house, and children in the yard, and children all around. And officers, you know, at an arc, I guess we're lucky that a child wasn't shot.
Yeah, in fact, I understand one of the bullets ricocheted into the room where the young 2-year-old child of Brian Andrus and Lori were was I don't know, sleeping or hiding or staying, whatever. We have in the studio with us as well another guest, a familiar one to those who listen to my show, Becky Johnson, who's a video journalist who actually just finished a taped segment for, I guess, Club Cruise, the show is. You actually were, well, I was a guest on the show, and this was a kind of a first take, a first look at this Brian Andrus shooting, right, Becky?
That's right. We taped that episode recently, and you can. We don't have a taping date when that'll be in the air, but we'll let you know. Club Cruise does air Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. on Channel 71, and also on Saturdays at 9:30 p.m. That is a weekly show. We will have that on an upcoming episode. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the issues that have come up around this Button Street shooting. The police knew who Brian Andrus was. He was on probation at the time. He was not intoxicated. There was ample reason for people to believe that he was intoxicated. but we later found that that was not true. And you'll notice in some of the later articles there was no mention of any intoxication. No retraction, mind you. But no mention of it. So you know that if he was intoxicated, they would have mentioned it. Again, I think that the early reports of throwing of bottles were not substantiated. After the shooting, police made Lori Andrus leave her home and against her will. She was the alleged victim of a domestic violence incident. She in no way had committed any crime. This is completely illegal for them to have done. They took her and her child under police escort, isolated her from all neighbors, didn't allow her to be with anyone or near anyone. They took her to the police station for lengthy grilling. Then they dropped her and her child off at a motel at 11 p.m. without giving her any food or diapers. They would not allow her to return to her home because they were doing an extensive search of her house at that time. Also questionably legal, since she had not been charged with a crime, and the crime that her husband had been charged with, battery, didn't seem to substantiate a search of his house. I'm not sure what the law is on that. The police did not tell her the medical condition of her husband. They told her that her husband was to be booked into county jail later that night, when in reality he was being airlifted to San Jose Medical Center and in surgery. His condition, reported in the paper as being fair condition, went from fair to serious to critical, and the last report, which we got was yesterday, was that he had was getting better. He was upgraded to serious. These were three bullet wounds to the abdomen. Another one of the really most outrageous aspects of this case is after Brian Andrus had been shot with four bullets, was lying on the sidewalk in front of his house, the police went over and took off all of his clothing. I mean, they stripped the man naked in front of his wife, in front of his child, in front of the neighbors. What could be the possible rationale except to add insult to injury? The rationale given for this heinous act was that they were trying to determine where the bullet holes.